Welcome to Talking Supply Chain. In each episode, you'll hear from the authors that make Supply Chain Management Review such a special publication. This podcast is hosted by Bob Troublecock, Editorial Director of Supply Chain Management Review. Remember that Bob welcomes your comments now to today's episode. Welcome to today's episode of Talking Supply Chain, a shot in the arm, or how science, engineering, and supply chains converged to vaccinate the world. I'm Bob Troublecock, and with me today is Yossi Sheffi. Yossi is the Elisha Gray Professor of Engineering Systems and the Director of the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics. He's also the author of 6 award-winning books on supply chain management, including his new book, which is also the title of the podcast, A Shot in the Arm, How Science, Engineering, and Supply Chains Converged to Vaccinate the World. Yossi, welcome.
Thank you very much, Bob. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're thrilled to have you here, as always. To kick us off, I want to read one of the blurbs for Yossi's new book. In a tour de force, Yossi Sheffi offers strategic lessons behind the record-breaking development, production, and global delivery of the COVID vaccines and what they mean for the future. Now, besides the fact that any author would be thrilled to have that blurb on the back of their book, what caught my eye is that Robert Langer, the author of the blurb, is not only a colleague of Yossi's at MIT, he's also a co-founder of Moderna. He's a guy who should know. So Yossi, the last time we spoke was on the publication of your last book about the pandemic. Once again, congratulations. Let's start with a simple question. Why did you want to tell this story? What interested you about the vaccine development as a supply chain professional?
Well, the story was after I did my last book, The New Abnormal, it became clear that something else is going on. You know, the book came out exactly as there were rumors that the vaccine is passing phase, some of the vaccine are passing phase 3. And I started thinking, okay, that's going to be a huge logistic challenge of taking the vaccines from, the labs to production, but then giving them to billions of people, billions and billions of people more than once. Said this is going to be quite a logistics operation. So as a supply chain professional, I said, wow, there are a lot of interesting things behind this. And that I would like to understand better. I would like to document. I would like to see if there are lessons that can be learned from this. So that's what got me really interested in the vaccine story.
You know, when you talk about the logistics issues, I remember, you know, I live in a small town in New Hampshire, and we set up they set up outdoor vaccination areas that the state funded. And in this case, it was at the athletic fields at Keene State College. And one of the things, a friend of mine who is a retired urologist was kind of leading the charge in terms of organizing volunteer doctors and nurses. And one of the things I learned from him was that they had all kinds of vaccine. There wasn't a problem of vaccine shortage or even the getting the vaccine there. They didn't have needles. And he said, when you come up, you don't know what kind of a needle you're going to get because we've just got to use whatever we can get because there's a needle shortage. And you never think about going to the doctor like, oh, geez, I wonder if they're going to have enough needles. But it wasn't just the vaccine. It was the accessories or things that went along with what you needed to administer the vaccines. And that one just caught my eye. Sure. And then I noticed when I got my first shot, it was a pretty long needle. It wasn't like the normal thing that you would use to administer a vaccine because that's what they had on hand.
Yeah. Let me just add to this story that there were so many other challenges to the development even before the vaccine was ready. When you have 130 companies developing vaccines and dozens of companies developing testing, they're all looking toward the same material. They all need right. A lot of the same material. They also, especially the mRNA vaccine, needed a very, very cold chain. So there was shortage of everything that people had to overcome as in addition to the scientific challenge of developing vaccine in record time, there was the supply chain challenge of just getting the material, putting up all the factories, the warehouses. It was an impressive operation.
In your previous books, you've tackled a number of topics that I think have changed supply chain management, including risk management, resilience, and how we might reshape our businesses and supply chains for the future. Think about what you learned from those previous books in your research. How do those shape how you approached this book?
Well, there's something that goes through all my business books. And this is, I try to do as much as possible my own research, in that I talk to companies, I talk to people, I collect data. I try to do what's called primary research. Of course, in order to make sure that people understand that I did not invent it, I always try to find some reference to this, some background. Even when people tell me something, I still try to find something in the media, in the scientific literature, to back it up. But this I did in all my books. But about the topics, of course, this was the ultimate case of disruption. In my 2005, 2015 books, was the Resilient Enterprise and the Power of Resilience, I talked about what you might now look at small disruptions, whether it's hurricanes or even Japan or Katrina or BP in the Gulf. All these disruptions were limited. They were limited because they were limited in geographically and in time. And, you know, having a little bit of inventory, which people always have, even when they run just in time, and having good processes and being ready for this and drilling helped. This was not the case during the pandemic. It was really a different type of disruption. We're still living it today, because this was disruption, as much as I can say, engineered by the government. Not realizing, of course, that they are doing it. It's the law of unintended consequences. But the market is flooded with money. Demand outstrips supply by a lot. And supply, unlike demand, that you can prime the market and give people a lot of money and they run out and buy, you cannot do it with supply. Supply is a question of physics. It takes time to build a factory. It takes time to, increase production. It just takes time. And you only have so many ships and so many trucks and so many drivers and so many vessels. And on top of it, of course, the amount of money in the market help people be a lot more choosy what kind of work to do and if they want to work in the first place. So in many ways, this is a very different type of disruption. And it is a very different type of disruption, so that we are still living through. So it helped to compare and contrast to the other disruption, but my previous books were really about different types of disruption. And this is, as I said, it's the main benefit here is to compare and contrast.
I want to come back to the book in a second, but I wanted to ask a question just based on the last answer you talked about. One of the things I've heard from a number of supply chain officers just in the last couple of months was I've called it the first supply chain casualty of COVID was planning. I've had a number of people tell me the same thing. One was that when we shut down in the spring of 2020, there was no historical precedent, or as one guy said, well, there was the Spanish flu, but nobody's still around, 100 years later. And the flip side, when I had the conversation with that particular supply chain officer, it was like last August. So when we thought we would be coming out of it, and he said, the flip side is we have no historical precedent for coming out of something like this. We just don't know how to plan. Is sort of like, when you wrote about resilience, we started hearing lots of people talk about, risk management and resilience. Do you think planning is going to be a big focus for transforming supply chains going forward?
I think we will continue planning. As Eisenhower said, it's the planning, not the plan. And no plan survives the first encounter with the enemy. So planning is important to socialize the organization, to coordinate. So I don't see the end of planning. Planning is still important. However, maybe we will start doing more analysis, trying to decide if the planning parameters are as grounded as we think they are, and try to do, not only a plan, but a high plan and a low plan and a plan in between. So actually, in some way, there'll be more planning because we will be planning for more eventualities. And some of them have to do with, things really beyond the control of the company in terms of geopolitical forces, in terms of trade disputes. So, for example, I know one very well-known company that has a plan for what happened if China attacks Taiwan. So at least it's more scenario planning, looking at the scenario and what can happen. It's not such as detailed plan as what we're going to do next month. But so companies are actually planning for a lot more eventuality because the world is becoming more and more variable, stochastic, random. So you have to plan for more scenarios and more types of future. And not only plan for them, but try to decipher what it is that will make you decide that the future is going in direction A or direction B or direction C. So what we call sensors in the ground. Try to get what are the, eventualities that will let you know. For example, here, let me give you one scenario. It is fairly clear to most supply chain, to most, I would say, mature supply chain professionals that at the end of this will not end well with what's going on now, that we will get into a recession because of the bullwhip effect, because it always happened. There's too much. You see, the market is now just like before the tech crash. You see companies getting valuations, but have no profits just based on assumptions and based on hope. So the market is becoming very high, lots of money moving around. It will not end up well because companies are also ordering twice and three times more than they need, which means that at one point, as the Fed starts, and you see inflation, so as the Fed starts to fight inflation, demand will go down. Companies with a lot of inventory will have to get rid of the inventory, so they'll stop ordering. Their suppliers will start laying off people. Demand will go even further down, and we start having this feedback loop that leads to recessions. Now, when it's going to happen, I don't know. But almost every company that I talk to is starting to think this way. A company that I talked to yesterday, a company in the Boston area, a well-known company, had to add supply because demand went to the roof right now. So it had to add all kinds of suppliers. And it's now very methodically divided from A, B, and C suppliers. And it knows already which supplier it's going to cut when the downturn comes. It knows already which B supplier is going to reduce orders. It's going to know which A supplier it has to keep because these are strategic, critical suppliers. They do the whole planning now. So this is an example of planning that is done, and they don't know when they're going to use this plan, but they're fairly sure that they'll have to use it. Anyway, I gave you a long answer to a short question.
No, that was actually a great answer. Let's move back to your book. So kind of a two-part question. The first was, as you were writing, what do you think are the most important lessons you took away from this story? And perhaps what surprised you the most?
Well, the first part of the book, the first chapter, it says five chapters. The first chapter of the book is actually about the science. And to do this, I was very fortunate to be able to talk to some of the leading scientists in the world. So you mentioned Bob Langer. I also talked to Phil Sharp, who is a Nobel laureate at MIT, microbiologist and biochemist. I also talked to Katie Corricu, who is the, in many ways, people think the inventors or the person who enables all the mRNA. She's with BioNTech, the company that Pfizer, it's a Pfizer vaccine, but it's not developed by Pfizer, developed by BioNTech. She's now a senior vice president at BioNTech. So I was able to talk to some of the people who really, you know, were involved in the development. And Katie Corricu, for example, 30 years ago, started saying that mRNA is the way to go. Nobody listened to her. For 20 years, she was working in the wilderness. And nobody would fund her. People said she's dreaming, it's never going to work. So she couldn't get funding for her research. And she kept going until she moved to the United States, to Penn State, the University of Pennsylvania. Moved to, I think, to University of Pennsylvania. And there she teamed up with another researcher, and they're able to start getting some funding and start developing the methodology that enabled the use of mRNA, because the mRNA itself would be rejected by the body. So you have to put around it some things that will allow it to get into the cell, to do its thing and disappear, and get the cell itself. That's the thing about mRNA. It's not something that the vaccine has. The vaccine simply makes the cell start being active in fighting any viruses, or especially this type of virus. So it, to me, first of all, it was fascinating to learn and then to write about something that I knew virtually nothing about. It's I felt that the book on the vaccine, you need one chapter at least to tell you what it is, how it was developed. People think it was a miracle. Turned out it's you know, Phil Sharp at MIT won 35 years ago, won a Nobel Prize on something that later on was used in the mRNA vaccine. So it's lots of people were working for many years. And then, of course, there were some breakthrough. And with the idea that it was developed within 9 or 10 months is just amazing, because people thought it would take 10 years. So this was just understanding and being part of it. I was talking to several people in Moderna, to the supply chain people, to the IT or digital information people. Very interesting. And I document why Moderna was able to do it so quickly, even though they were nothing, small company with really very little resources. Pfizer, I understand, Pfizer is a giant. But the fact that Moderna was able to do it around the same time is actually amazing. So when you say, what surprised me, talk about the lessons I learned. First of all, my many lessons, and maybe we'll talk about it towards the end, because some of the lessons were how the world can fight other big challenges, so how the world can tackle other big challenges like global warming. Because what we saw in this was unbelievable collaboration between competitors, even in development of vaccine. Let me give you one example, if we have time.
Sure. So,
the example is monkeys. You know, you need monkeys to do the experiments on before even you go to phase one, phase two, phase three, before you put, you know, chemicals into people. So the world needed monkey, and there was huge competition because there's 130 companies were developing vaccines, and then companies were developing testing, and you need monkeys in order to do other development. Turns out China is the source of 80% of the monkeys in the world, and China stopped, put the regulated monkeys. They said cannot send them out of China, cannot export monkeys, because they wanted, they had five companies in China that were developing vaccine, and they wanted them for the Chinese companies. What resulted in is an amazing collaboration between competitors. Because, as you know, take, for example, company A and company B. They are both developing very different vaccines. They both need monkeys. But what they do is they divide, let's say, the population of monkeys by half. They give half of them the vaccine and half of them placebo, right? The other company also give their vaccines and placebo. So what they did, they can collaborate on the placebo. It can be the same monkeys that get the placebo. They don't have, you don't have each company giving the placebo to its own monkeys because it doesn't matter. They don't get, they don't take anything. So this is an example. People started thinking out of the box and collaborating. It was very interesting. It happened during the pandemic also. I documented in my previous book. But when the chips are down, when the crisis is so real, companies do work together and work for the betterment of humanity. So in that sense, it was a very hopeful conclusion.
I find the monkey shortage fascinating. I mean, we've heard about shortages of about everything else you can think of, but had not heard about a monkey shortage. So that's actually both a great anecdote and a great sense of collaboration. So like most people, you know, there was a Sunday morning where I watched a lift truck load a pallet of vaccines onto the back of a truck at a Pfizer plant in Michigan. And, you know, anybody that's been around manufacturing or distribution for any length of time, I grew up in the pallet industry, so I've seen lots of pallets and lots of, lift trucks loading pallets onto a truck. It's pretty mundane, and yet that was a pretty exciting day. And then after that, what we started hearing about was all the difficulties around distribution. So what role did supply chains play in the development of the vaccine and the distribution of the vaccine?
Supply chains, in the book, I document specifically Moderna because I had a deep discussion with them about all the difficulty. And it was like continuous fight. There were one bottleneck, they were solving one, they got it to another. As you said, there were so many things, that the vials and needles and this material and that material and transportation and monkeys, everything. They just couldn't get everything to work together, but yet they did it. So, you know, inventing, cajoling, asking help, they did. That's why I'm saying that when people say supply chain didn't work, you should talk to some of the people who actually did it. I mean, under unbelievable conditions. But coming back, so of course, everything, supply chain professionals that work in, whether it was J&J or Pfizer or Moderna or any one of the other companies who were developing vaccines, they were overcoming all these difficulties. When we came to the distribution, it's really a different story because governments control the distribution. And here, and one should say, by the way, the Trump administration deserved tremendous credit for Operation Warp Speed. It funded a lot of vaccine development. Some of them fail. For example, Merck. Merck developed a vaccine. Good company, large company. It didn't work. So this is not a given that you start developing, you'll come out with vaccine. Yet you spend millions of dollars before you realize something doesn't work. So the government funded, you know, parallel development, understanding that some will fail and some will not. And this is, to me, lots of credit to the previous government for doing this, because this is unlike government. To take risks like this and knowing that some will fail, it worked. But, you hear about the success. There were also some failure, but that's the beauty of it. It's like a venture capitalist, you know. It's enough that 10% of the company will work and be a big success. So that was actually great. But after that, what happened in the, you know, and you should look basically at the states. It begin with, it was not the distribution from the McKesson, the government used McKesson, one of the, pharma distributors, it was a good decision, but they did not you know, it didn't work as well as planned to get to the States. There were lots of uncertainty, not clear what's going on. And then the states, at the beginning, really, many states screwed up. Not all the states, but for example, Massachusetts, it did not work well at all at the beginning because they did not understand fundamental supply chain management principles. For example, they, in order to be equitable, they tried to send the vaccine to a lot of small clinics all over Massachusetts. This is absolutely the wrong thing to do because we ended up throwing out a lot of vaccines because when you have a small number of people and a small number of vaccines, there's a huge uncertainty, huge volatility, what we call the ratio between the standard deviation and the mean can be very large, which means sometimes you'll have people coming and not have vaccines. Sometimes you'll have vaccine and people are not going to come and you'll have to throw them out. The idea, I understand, they're trying to make sure that they get to a lot of communities, but they didn't understand the vaccine, that vaccination is a numbers game. It doesn't matter who you vaccinate, as long as you put needles into arms, because you need to vaccinate everybody or as large number as possible. After a while, they understood and they start opening the big centers, you know, Fenway Park and you know, Gillette Stadium, and started to, because when you have thousands of vaccines and thousands of people every day, yeah, for the most part, it will be fine. I also give lots of examples from other countries. For example, Israel immediately started at the end of every day, said, okay, it's not 65 plus. Anybody who come at the end of the day, if they have vaccines, and a whole system of transmitting to the neighborhood, come and get it. So the vaccination rate in Israel started going very far, very quick.
I want two questions left. And for the next one, I want to go back to something that you talked about and revisit it, which was how will this initiative, which was really, I think, maybe not as big in scope as D-Day, but, you know, pretty unprecedented in terms of spoke, how will this initiative help us in future challenges? For instance, you talked about attacking global warming.
Yes. Good. Okay. First of all, so let me know, it's the bad news and the good news story. The bad news is that we know that imagine we have about, I don't know, 35, a third of the U.S. population doesn't want to get vaccinated, doesn't want to, you know, to wear masks, doesn't believe that it's a problem. In my book, 3 books ago, you know, I wrote a book called Balancing Green about sustainability. And I said, and I documented with data and I did my own experiments, that most people tell pollsters that they believe in sustainability, they'll pay for sustainability, but in the supermarket shelf, they don't. So right. I quoted a study that 80% of people say they're going to pay 5% more for sustainable product. Then you go to Stop and Shop and several other stores. And when they have green awning with a product that are like from recyclable paper or a detergent without harsh chemicals, and people don't buy them. They buy, you know, the regular product. So I should say about 7 to 10% of the people would buy sustainable product. But don't forget, this is also in Boston, which is one of the more progressive places in the United States. So my guess, the average around the country is even lower. But in any case, so the question is as follows. If you cannot convince people who are facing death and misery, when we have already close to, or maybe over, I don't know, around 800,000 people dead, and we'll get to 1 million and beyond the way things are going. And people have long COVID and people suffer. You cannot convince them to take the vaccine. You cannot convince them to be careful. How do you convince them to reduce their, you know, standard of living for the sake of a danger that is decades and decades in the future, if at all? The answer is you don't. despite all the talk, despite everything, people are not going to act decisively against global warming, Glasgow, Paris, notwithstanding. Because, and we see it, by the way, when the French government, and that's in Europe, tried to put a carbon tax, which is, by the way, the most efficient way to fight global warming, because you align economic and sustainability objectives. Paris went to burning. The whole, you know, yellow vest movement started because of this. And then the Australian government fell, and the slogan was X the tax, because they put a carbon tax. It's just people are not willing to do it. They're not willing to fly less. They're not ready to consume less. They're not. And I always ask my students, who are getting very angry when I say it, how many of you are buying on Amazon and get stuff within 2 hours? And I said, you are all in transportation. You know that when you order stuff and it has to come from a distribution center on the outskirts of Boston, and you get it in 2 hours, you know that it takes an hour just to find it in the warehouse, and then, you know, 45 minutes to drive to you. Do you think they have the time to build an efficient tour to serve other people in your neighborhood? They don't. They just put it in a van. It comes to you. But how many of you are still ordering on Amazon? So we are all doing this. So the solution, as I argue in my previous book, is technology. And let me come back to the vaccine now. How did we solve the vaccine? How did we fight the pandemic? We fought it through technology. We developed vaccines. And now, you know, Merck and Pfizer are developing pharmaceutical that you take when you just start to get sick, and it helps you not to get on a ventilator or not to get to the hospitals. It's all technology. It's all developing in, you know, life science and biotechnology and microbiology. The same way, I think we will need to develop technologies to fight global warming. And we have the first phase of technology, which is renewables, but renewables are limited because the wind is always not always flowing, and the sun not always shine. And also it takes a huge tract of land, and nobody wants this thing in their backyard. So you get some, but they're limited. They're not going to solve the problem. On top of this, you know, almost two-thirds of the world are living than less than $5 a day. They also want air conditioning and drive cars and eat meat and then live in concrete houses. What are you going to tell them? No, the rich world has done its thing. We live well. You guys are doomed to stay in the tents that you live in. That's ridiculous. It's immoral, and it should not stand. So the solution also to global warming is developing technology, and mostly what's called carbon capture and sequestration, taking carbon already in the air, because reducing emission is not going to work, because of all the developing world that's just going to go to middle class standard of living, and emission will just go through the roof. So, and also people even in the rich world, they say they're willing to do it, most of them are not. Sons, you know, not excluding teenage girls from Sweden. Okay, put them aside. Most people are just not willing to do it. So we need, so I said, solution is technology to reduce the carbon already in the air, not only reduce the rate of growth of emission, but actually reversing the carbon already in the air. And now come the good news. We saw during the pandemic how the governments put billions and then billions of dollars to develop the vaccines, and then trillions of dollars for the economic problems that came out of it. We have very similar problem. Just like the vaccine, global warming is a global problem. The vaccine, you have to vaccinate everybody in the world. You're not going to solve anything until a large percentage is vaccinated. Same thing in global warming. The fact that California would have an EV mandate is nothing, meaningless, compared to the fact that China and India are still building coal plants. So the whole world needs to act together. And it's very hard to incentivize. People are making statements. We know that the Paris people signed to the Paris Accord, made all kinds of statements. Only nobody, I should say nobody, most places didn't live to their commitments. So we need to develop, as I said, this technology. And the good news is, as I said, that for the developing, for working against the pandemic, the world spent billions and trillions of dollars. So we should start spending, instead of thinking, for example, and this is just thinking about all wrong, instead of the Glasgow thinking about how much the rich world is going to pay the poor world in order not to increase the standard of living, basically. That's ridiculous. Instead, they should put these billions of dollars that they're talking about towards developing technologies. And there are lots of ways of doing this. They can announce Nobel Prizes and all kind of new commitments to develop these types of things. It's a whole range. It's not one technology. It's a whole range of technologies. And if they really think that that global warming is the danger that they think it is, they should pay trillions of dollars now. And we saw that the money is there. That's the good news. When the danger is clear, the money is there and people cooperate and solve it. So directing UN governments and there are too much focus on equity and too much focus on who is still emitting greenhouse gas and who is not, how much, and just squabbling. Instead of this, you should just get together and develop technology to solve it. So that's what I hope will happen. And that's what, this was my optimistic conclusion when I finish documenting what happened with the pandemic. And the last part of the book, I actually talk about it.
One quick last question, and I'm not going to ask you to predict when the supply chain shortages will be over. But when you and I spoke last year, you said something that I've repeated, you know, over and over. It really struck with me, which was that supply chains didn't fail; they performed exactly as designed. A year later, you know, where are your views on that, and what do we do next?
Okay. Again, I am not usually not subscribed to the common wisdom in political circles, in the media, or whatever. I think the change in supply chain will be a lot smaller than people think. I think that not too many people are going to leave China, despite all the pressure. There will be some government action. For example, U.S., U.K., Japan, South Korea are putting billions of dollars into local semiconductor development because they realize the semiconductor equate to national security risks. So right. There will be items that will be done, but by and large, when you talk about supply chain, I don't think we will suddenly see a flourishing T-shirt production in Kansas City. It's just not going to happen. And furthermore, companies that produce sophisticated products, Chinese suppliers have become just too good. They're good quality, good availability, good capacity, good responsiveness in particular. So I don't, and also don't forget the Chinese market is huge. People are not going to leave the Chinese market. So I think it's not going to be that much of a change. And just in time, we don't see the end of just in time. Just in time will continue because it's just too good. And companies that will go to suddenly start keeping a large amount of inventory, not only the cost will go up, the quality will go up. The big change, the big impact of just in time was high quality. If you remember the Toyota production system. So I don't see company abandoning this. The good thing is that, as Niels Bohr, the famous physicist, once said, it's very hard to predict, especially the future. So, you don't know what will happen. There is a big change in how supply chain is perceived in companies and by everybody. Until February 2020, people used to ask my wife, what's your husband doing at MIT? She used to say he's doing research in supply chain management. And people say, what is this? Now, you know, she went to the supermarket a month ago and didn't have enough, cereal that she liked or something. And she asked the 16-year-old clerk, what's going on? And he said, you know, we have supply chain problems. So it's now becoming, you know, everybody understands what supply chain management is about. You see in companies, supply chain is getting a lot more attention. You see in the government. I always, you know, when I'm talking to friends in government, asking why they don't have literally the Office of Supply Chain Management. And I think now they have all kind of committees and, you know, in the Commerce Department, in the White House, but people start to understand that it's important. So at government, in companies, on the streets, around the dinner table, people are paying more attention to this. People are paying more attention. There will be more innovations. And for example, one area that I expect will have something you already see, like the more use of robotics, more use of automation. That's partly because of the shortage of workers right now.
Right. Yeah.
But we will also have, I think, a lot more. I expect a push in developing 3D printing, because a lot of this is done locally, or you can do it locally. So there will be, it's still very slow and very expensive, but for certain parts it makes sense. And I think there will be a push, significant push for 3D printing, as well as all kind of other, you know, systems in order to get better visibility, but visibility not only into what your suppliers are doing and what happens in far land, visibility into what the government is thinking about, because government actions affect companies in many, many ways, of course, and more than ever we see now. So anyway, some of the things that I'm thinking about.
Great. I think you're right on the 3D printing. I'm actually running an article in the November issue of SCMR, because it just felt as if the pandemic, might have accelerated that technology. But in any event, Yossi, that's all the time we have today. I really want to thank you for joining us. Loved hearing about the book. And for those interested, A Shot in the Arm, How Science, Engineering, and Supply Chains Converge to Vaccinate the World is available as an ebook and paperback on Amazon.com. If you just Google Yossi Sheffy, you'll find it. And I'm going to be publishing an excerpt from the book in the December issue of SCMR. So again, thanks to all my listeners for joining today. We hope you'll be back for our next episode. For Talking Supply Chain, I'm Bob Troublecock. Talking Supply Chain is produced by Supply Chain Management Review and Peerless Media. You can find it on scmr.com, on iTunes, or under SC247, or just Google SC247 podcasts. For more information, be sure to visit scmr.com. We hope you'll join us again.